The Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 6, Explosions, Part 1. It's 1942 in the mountains of New Mexico, and scientists are moving here with a project that will see an explosive end to the largest war the world has ever seen.
People talk about the Manhattan Project today as if it was a half a dozen physicists off on a mountain somewhere. In fact, it was an enormous effort. It was bigger than the U.S. auto industry of the time. There was over 100,000 people involved, if you add it all up. It consumed something like 10% of all the electricity generated in the United States. My name's Dave Wark. I'm a professor of particle physics at University of Oxford. I was born and grew up in the United States. I was a graduate student at Caltech, and then I was a postdoc at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. So I actually knew a number of people who were involved in the Manhattan Project. And of course, as a particle physicist, we are taught all of the physics underlying the reactions that enable you to build nuclear weapons.
Professor Wark was called up by a former tutee of his at Balliol College, Oxford, Angus Jackson, who is now directing the play Oppenheimer, about Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb, head of the Manhattan Project.
He thought he would get me to come and talk to the cast and to the writer, Tom Morton Smith, about both the physics of how you build nuclear weapons, but also a bit about the people involved, because I knew some of them.
But the Manhattan Project wouldn't have happened at all if it weren't for an important scientific discovery. In 1938, two German physicists discovered nuclear fission.
Fission is the splitting apart of a large nucleus into two smaller nuclei. That releases a huge amount of energy. In the process, it also emits some neutrons. And that's significant because the fission itself is created by the collision of a neutron with a nucleus.
So if you have a neutron that splits an atom apart and produces some neutrons, then those neutrons can hit another atom and make that atom split apart, or fission. That's more neutrons released. That splits more atoms, more neutrons, more atoms. What you get is a chain reaction that sustains and feeds itself. The whole thing runs away and creates a massive release of energy.
This was obvious to people within days of the discovery of fission. The question is, can you take that scientific idea and turn it into a workable device? And that's what the Manhattan Project did. It took that scientific idea and turned it into something that will fit in an aircraft and will level a city.
The level of energy released by an atomic bomb is hard to comprehend. The units that are used are kilo and even megatons. A kiloton is equivalent to the energy released by setting off 1,000 tons of TNT.
And a way to think about that is that, a bomb dropped from an aircraft that you see these pictures on television of buildings being leveled and all, those tend to be somewhere between 500 and 1,000 pounds. And so we're talking about something which is thousands of times bigger than that is one kiloton. The bomb that leveled Hiroshima is 16 kilotons. And these days we can build them up into the megaton range, thousands of times even bigger than that.
So what is it about the story of the Manhattan Project that makes it so compelling?
The cast of characters, that you have to choose from when you're trying to write a play about the Manhattan Project is fascinating. It's vast. You couldn't possibly put all those people in a play. You couldn't fit them on the stage. The Manhattan Project is a story. If ever there was a Shakespearean story in the last century, it has to be that, because the number of different tensions involved are enormous. I mean, of course, there's the absolutely obvious one, which is you have university academics who normally do nothing more deadly than swatting a fly, who someone comes to them and says, oh, please would you spend the next 3 years building something that will incinerate an entire city?
The ethical implications of this were huge. There were also the internal struggles of the scientists involved on the project, many of whom were either refugees from Nazi Germany or the students of refugees from Nazi Germany.
because on the one hand, they were being asked to build a weapon which, when the project started, they believed would probably be used against their own country. On the other hand, they were using it to destroy a regime where they had absolutely no illusions of the evil of it. And so, I mean, this is a tremendously strong moral dilemma, which, of course, is the heart of great drama. In Oppenheimer, of course, there's a second source of tension, of drama that interacts with that, which is that many of the scientists of that day, and especially Oppenheimer and his immediate following, were communists.
In the 20s and 30s, it was quite common for intellectuals to be communists.
As the war went on, and in particular when the Soviets and the Nazis signed a non-aggression pact, many of these people, you know, lost their faith in the Soviet Union as a realization of communism. Some people lost their faith in communism altogether, but some didn't. And so there was this great tension between these people as to, you know, who used to share a common thread of political belief, and they no longer did.
Add to this the backdrop of an American government who were ideologically opposed to communism and concerned for the security of the project.
So they put huge pressure on Oppenheimer to get rid of the people who hadn't turned their back on leftist beliefs.
Why did scientists do something they knew would be so devastating?
I don't think it was difficult at that time to get people scared enough of the Nazis getting the bomb first that they would participate. In fact, the Manhattan Project came about when Albert Einstein, who's, you know, one of the world's great pacifists, was induced to write a letter to President Roosevelt warning him of the possibilities of building such a weapon. So the initial involvement of people in building these weapons, I think very few people declined to do it, and very few people, I think, felt that they had ever done anything wrong by initially pursuing it.
But as time wore on, it became clear that the Nazis weren't going to be able to build a nuclear bomb.
A few dropped out at that point, but the vast majority continued. Some of the scientists pushed ahead just because they had become so involved in this project and they just wanted to see if it worked. The military, General Groves, I think, continued to push because they had devoted a staggering amount of resource to building these bombs. In the play, Oppenheimer sort of puts a third point, which to my mind is perhaps the best reason of all why it had to be used, which was, as he says in the play, it's entirely possible, which means it's entirely inevitable that people will build such weapons, and it is critical that they be used and people know the horrors of these things, because otherwise the next war will start with nuclear weapons, rather than this war being finished by nuclear weapons.
On the 6th of August 1945, the world's first nuclear weapon was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. 3 days later, Nagasaki was destroyed by an even larger bomb, ending the war. The tangled legacy of the Manhattan Project pairs one of humanity's greatest achievements with one of its darkest hours.
Different people after the war felt very differently about this. Many people, to the end of their days, believed they were right to do what they did for some combination of these reasons. Others felt very, very guilty about it. I think most of the people felt a bit of both, felt that they probably did what they had to do, but just like many, many people who've served in war, they felt they did what they had to do, but it doesn't make them feel that much better about the people they had to kill. Perhaps the greatest consequence of all of nuclear weapons on our modern world is that our modern world is here, because it's a point of history you can debate, but I at least believe that if there weren't nuclear weapons, the Second World War would have been followed not by a Cold War, but by a hot war. And that war would have made the Second World War look like a barroom brawl. And the effects it would have had on our world today, I think, would have been devastating. So, yes, we live under the shadow of nuclear destruction, but for that reason, we don't live under the shadow of conventional destruction.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Lou Sumner, and produced by the University of Oxford. You can find a full list of credits and much more besides at our website, oxfordsparks.net.